cafe is open to them. Note, all these women with this little delicate and touch-me-not air accumulated by a whole past of slavery, with no other means of salvation and livelihood than this unintentional seductive air biding its time. Jules Laforgue. The man also is calculating about money and success, but he has the means to acquire them through his work. The woman has been assigned the role of parasite. All parasites are necessarily exploiters. She needs the male to acquire human dignity, to eat, to feel pleasure, to procreate. She uses the service of sex to ensure her benefits, and since she is trapped in this function, she is entirely an instrument of exploitation. As for falsehoods, except in the case of prostitution, there is no fair arrangement between her and her protector. Man even requires her to play act. He wants her to be the other. But every existent, as desperately as he may disavow himself, remains a subject. He wants her to be object. She makes herself object. At the moment she makes herself being, she is exercising a free activity. This is her original treason. The most docile, the most passive woman is still consciousness, and it is sometimes enough to make him feel duped by her for the male to glimpse that in giving herself to him, she is watching and judging him. She should be no more than an offered thing, a prey. Nonetheless, he also demands that she surrender this thing to him freely. In bed, he asks her to feel pleasure. At home, she must sincerely recognize his superiority and his strengths. At the very moment she obeys, she must also feign independence, even though she actively plays the role of passivity at other moments. She lies to keep her man and ensure her daily bread. Scenes and tears, uncontrollable transports of love, hysterics, and she lies as well to escape the tyranny she accepts out of self-interest. He encourages play-acting, as it feeds his imperialism and vanity. She uses her powers of dissimulation against him. Revenge is thus doubly delicious, for in deceiving him, she satisfies her own particular desires, and she savors the pleasure of mocking him. The wife and the courtesan lie in feigning transports they do not feel. Afterward, with their lovers or girlfriends, they make fun of the naive vanity of their dupe. Not only do they botch it, but they want us to wear ourselves out, moaning with pleasure, they say resentfully. These conversations resemble those of servants who criticize their bosses in the servants' kitchen. The woman has the same faults because she is a victim of the same paternalistic oppression. She has the same cynicism because she sees the man from head to toe as a valet sees his master. But it is clear that none of these traits manifests a perverted essence or a perverted original will. They reflect a situation. There is duplicity wherever there is a coercive regime, says Fourier. Prohibition and contraband are inseparable in love as in business. And men know so well that the woman's faults show her condition that, careful to maintain the hierarchy of the sexes, they encourage these very traits in their companion that allow them to scorn her. Doubtless, the husband or lover is irritated by the faults of the particular woman he lives with. Yet, extolling the charms of femininity in general, he considers it to be inseparable from its flaws. If the woman is not perfidious, futile, cowardly, or indolent, she loses her seduction. In A Doll's House, Helmer explains how just, strong, understanding, and indulgent man feels when he pardons his weak wife for her puerile faults. Thus, Bernstein's husbands are moved, with the author's complicity, by the thieving, cruel, adulterous wife. Bowing indulgently to her, they prove their virile wisdom. American racists and French colonialists wish the black man to be thieving, indolent, and lying. He proves his indignity, putting the oppressors in the right. If he insists on being honest and loyal, he is regarded as quarrelsome. Woman's faults are amplified all the more to the extent that she will not try to combat them, but, on the contrary, make an ornament of them. Rejecting logical principles and moral imperatives, skeptical about the laws of nature, woman lacks a sense of the universal. The world seems to her a confused collection of individual cases. This is why she more readily accepts a neighbor's gossip than a scientific explanation. She doubtless respects the printed book, but this respect skims along the written pages without grasping the content. By contrast, the anecdote told by an unknown person waiting in a line or in a drawing room instantly takes on overwhelming authority. In her domain, everything is magic. Outside, everything is mystery. She is ignorant of the criterion for credibility. Only immediate experience convinces her, her own experience or another's, as long as it is forcefully affirmed. As for herself, she feels she is a special case because she is isolated in her home and has no active contact with other women. She always expects destiny and men to make an exception in her favor. She believes in whatever insights come her way far more than in reasoning that is valid for everyone. She readily admits that they have been sent by God or by some obscure world spirit. In relation to misfortunes or accidents, she calmly thinks, "That can't happen to me," or else she imagines, "I'll be the exception." She enjoys special favors. The shopkeeper will give her a discount. The policeman will let her go to the head of the line. She has been taught to overestimate the value of her smile, but no one told her that all women smiled. It is not that she thinks herself more special than her neighbor. It is that she does not make comparisons. For the same reason, experience rarely proves her wrong. She suffers one failure, then another, but she does not add them up. This is why women do not succeed in building a solid counter-universe where they can defy males. They sporadically rant against men in general. They tell stories about the bedroom or childbirth. They exchange horoscopes and beauty secrets. But to truly build this world of grievances that their resentment calls for, they lack conviction. Their attitude to man is too ambivalent. Indeed, he is a child, a contingent and vulnerable body, an innocent, an unwanted drone, a mean tyrant, an egotist, a vain man, and he is also the liberating hero, the divinity who sets the standards. His desire is a gross appetite. His embrace is a degrading chore. Yet his ardor and virile force are also a demiurgic energy. When a woman ecstatically utters, "This is a man," she is evoking both the sexual vigor and the social effectiveness of the male she admires. In both are expressed the same created sovereignty. She does not think he can be a great artist, a grand businessman, a general, or a chief, without being a great lover. His social success is always a sexual attraction. Inversely, she is ready to recognize genius in the man who satisfies her. She is, in fact, turning to a masculine myth here. The phallus for Lawrence and many others is both living energy and human transcendence. Thus, in the pleasures of the bed, woman can see a communion with the spirit of the world. Worshipping man as in a mystical cult, she loses and finds herself in his glory. The contradiction is easily perceived here due to the different types of individuals who are virile. Some, whose contingents she encounters in everyday life, are the incarnation of human misery. In others, man's grandeur is exalted. But the woman even accepts that these two figures be fused into one. "If I become famous," wrote a girl in love with a man she considered superior, "R will surely marry me because it will flatter his vanity. His chest will swell with me on his arm." Yet she admired him madly. The same individual in the eyes of the woman may very well be stingy, mean, vain, foolish, and a god. After all, gods have their weaknesses. One feels a demanding severity, the opposite of authentic esteem, for an individual who is loved in his freedom and humanity, whereas a woman kneeling before her male can very well pride herself on knowing how to deal with him or handle him, and she complacently flatters his weaknesses without his losing prestige. This is the proof that she does not feel friendship for his individual person as expressed in his real acts. Blindly, she bows to the general essence her idol is part of. Virility is a sacred aura, a given fixed value, which is affirmed despite the weaknesses of the individual who bears it. This individual does not count, By contrast, the woman, jealous of his privilege, is delighted to exercise sly superiority over him. The same ambiguity of woman's feelings for man is found in her general attitude concerning herself and the world. The domain in which she is enclosed is invested by the masculine universe, but it is haunted by obscure forces of which men themselves are the playthings. If she allies herself with these magical virtues, she will, in her turn, acquire power. Society subjugates nature, but nature dominates it. The spirit affirms itself over life, but it dies if life no longer supports it. Woman uses this ambivalence to assign more truth to a garden than a city, to an illness than an idea, to a birth than a revolution. She tries to reestablish this reign of the earth, of the mother, imagined by Bachofen, to be able to find herself as the essential facing the inessential. But as she herself is an existent that a transcendence inhabits, she will only be able to valorize this region where she is confined by transfiguring it. She lends it a transcendent dimension. Man lives in a coherent universe that is a thought reality. Woman struggles with a magic reality that does not allow thinking. She escapes through thoughts lacking real content. Instead of assuming her existence, she contemplates in the heavens the pure idea of her destiny. Instead of acting, she erects her statue in her imagination. Instead of reasoning, she dreams. From here comes the fact that while being so physical, she is also so artificial. While being so terrestrial, she can be so ethereal. Her life is spent scrubbing pots and pans, and it is a marvelous romance. Vassal to man, she believes she is his idol. Debased in her flesh, she exalts love. Because she is condemned to know only life's contingent facticity, she becomes priestess of the ideal. This ambivalence is marked by the way woman deals with her body. It is a burden, weakened by the species, bleeding every month, passively propagating. For her, it is not the pure instrument of her grasp on the world, but rather an opaque presence. It is not certain that it will give her pleasure, and it creates pains that tear her apart. It contains threats. She feels danger in her insides. Her body is hysterical because of the close connection between endocrine secretions and nervous and sympathetic systems, commanding muscles and viscera. It expresses reactions the woman refuses to accept. In sobs, convulsions, and vomiting, her body escapes her. It betrays her. It is her most intimate reality, but it is a shameful reality that she keeps hidden. And yet it is her marvelous double. She contemplates it in the mirror with amazement. It is the promise of happiness, a work of art, a living statue. She shapes it, adorns it, displays it. When she smiles into the mirror, she forgets her carnal contingents. In love's embrace, in motherhood, her image disappears. But often, dreaming about herself, she is surprised to be both that heroine and that flesh. Nature symmetrically provides her with a double face. It supplies the stew and incites mystical effusions. In becoming a housewife and mother, woman gave up her free getaways into fields and woods. She preferred the calm cultivation of the kitchen garden. She tamed flowers and put them in vases. Yet she is still exalted by moonlights and sunsets. In the terrestrial fauna and flora, she sees food and ornamentation before all. Yet a sap flows that is generosity and magic. Life is not only imminence and repetition, it is also a dazzling face of light. In flowering meadows, it is revealed as beauty. In tune with nature by the fertility of her womb, woman also feels swept by the breath that animates her and is spirit. And insofar as she is unsatisfied and feels like the uncompleted and unlimited girl, her soul will then rush forward on endlessly unwinding roads toward limitless horizons. Slave to her husband, children, and home, she finds it intoxicating to be alone, sovereign on the hillside. She is no longer spouse, mother, housewife, but a human being. She contemplates the passive world, and she recalls that she is a whole consciousness, an irreducible freedom. In front of the mystery of water and the mountain summit's thrust, Male supremacy is abolished. Walking through the heather, dipping her hand in the river, she lives not for others, but for herself. The woman who maintained her independence through all her servitudes will ardently love her own freedom in nature. The others will find in it only the pretext for refined raptures, and they will hesitate at twilight between the fear of catching a cold and a swooning soul. This double belonging to the carnal world and to a poetic world defines the metaphysics and wisdom to which the woman more or less explicitly adheres. She tries to combine life and transcendence. This is to say, she rejects Cartesianism and all doctrines connected to it. She is comfortable in a naturalism similar to that of the Stoics or Neoplatonists of the 16th century. It is not surprising that women, Margaret of Navarre being the first of them, should be attached to such a philosophy, at once so material and so spiritual. Socially Manichaean, the woman has a deep need to be ontologically optimistic. The moralities of action do not suit her. Since it is forbidden for her to act, she submits to the given. So the given must be good. But a good recognized by reason like that of Spinoza or by calculation like that of Leibniz cannot touch her. She requires a good that is a living harmony and within which she situates herself by the mere fact of living. The notion of harmony is one of the keys of the feminine universe. It implies perfection in immobility, the immediate justification of each element as part of the whole, and her passive participation in the totality. In a harmonious world, woman thus attains what man will seek in action. She has purchase on the world. She is necessary to it. She cooperates in the triumph of good. Moments women consider revelations are those where they discover they are in harmony with the reality based on peace with oneself. These are the moments of luminous happiness that Virginia Woolf in Mrs. Dalloway, in To the Lighthouse, that Catherine Mansfield, all through her work, grant to their heroines as a supreme recompense. The joy that is a surge of freedom is reserved for the man. What the woman knows is an impression of smiling plenitude. Note, out of reams of texts, I will cite Mabel Dodge's lines where the passage to a global vision of the world is not explicit, but is clearly suggested. It was a still autumn day, all yellow and crimson. Frida and I, in a lapse of antagonism, sat on the ground together, with the red apples piled all around us. We were warmed and scented by the sun and the rich earth, and the apples were living tokens of plenitude and peace and rich living. The rich, natural flow of the earth, like the sappy blood in our veins, made us feel gay, indomitable, and fruitful, like orchards. We were united for a moment, Frida and I, in a mutual assurance of self-sufficiency, made certain, as women are sometimes, of our completeness by the sheer force of our bountiful health. One understands that simple ataraxia, in her eyes, can be of utmost importance, as she normally lives in the tension of denial, recrimination, and demands. One could never reproach her for savoring a beautiful afternoon or the sweetness of an evening. But it is a delusion to try to find here the true definition of the hidden soul of the world. Good is not. The world is not harmony, and no individual has a necessary place in it. There is a justification, a supreme compensation, that society has always been bent on dispensing to woman. Religion. There must be religion for women, as for the people, for exactly the same reasons. When a sex or a class is condemned to immanence, the mirage of transcendence must be offered to it. It is to man's total advantage to have God endorse the codes he creates, and specifically because he exercises sovereign authority over the woman, it is only right that this authority be conferred on him by the sovereign being. Among others, for Jews, Muslims, and Christians, man is the master by divine right. Fear of God will stifle the slightest inclination of revolt in the oppressed. Their credulity can be counted on. Woman adopts an attitude of respect and faith before the masculine universe. God in his heaven seems barely farther from her than a government minister, and the mystery of Genesis matches that of an electrical power station. But more important, if she throws herself so willingly into religion, it is because religion fills a profound need. In modern civilization, where freedom plays an important role, even for the woman, religion becomes less of an instrument of constraint than of mystification. The woman is less often asked to accept her inferiority in the name of God than to believe, thanks to him, that she is equal to the male lord. Even the temptation to revolt is avoided by pretending to overcome injustice. The woman is no longer robbed of her transcendence, since she will dedicate her immanence to God. Souls' merits are judged only in heaven and not according to their terrestrial accomplishments. Here below, as Dostoevsky would have said, they are never more than occupations. Shining shoes or building a bridge is the same vanity. Over and above social discriminations, equality of the sexes is reestablished. This is why the little girl and the adolescent girl throw themselves into devotion with an infinitely greater fervor than their brothers. God's gaze that transcends his transcendence humiliates the boy. He will forever remain a child under this powerful guardianship. It is a more radical castration than that with which he feels his father's existence threatens him. But the eternal girl child finds her salvation in this gaze that metamorphoses her into a sister of the angels. It cancels out the privilege of the penis. A sincere faith helps the girl avoid all inferiority complexes. She is neither male nor female, but God's creature. This is why we find a virile steadfastness in the great female saints. Saint Bridget and Saint Catherine of Siena arrogantly tried to rule the world. They recognized no male authority. Catherine even directed her directors very severely. Joan of Arc and Saint Teresa followed their own paths with an intrepidness surpassed by no man. The Church sees to it that God never authorizes women to escape from male guardianship. It has put these powerful weapons in masculine hands only, refusal of absolution and excommunication. For her obstinate visions, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. Nevertheless, even subjected by God's will to men's laws, the woman finds a solid recourse against them through him. Masculine logic is refuted by mysteries. Male's pride becomes a sin. Their agitation is not only absurd, but culpable. Why remodel this world created by God himself? The passivity to which woman is doomed is sanctified. Reciting her rosary by the fire, she knows she is closer to heaven than her husband, who is out at political meetings. There is no need to do anything to save her soul. It is enough to live without disobeying. The synthesis of life and spirit is completed. The mother not only engenders body, but also gives God a soul. This is higher work than penetrating the secrets of the atom. With the complicity of the Heavenly Father, woman can make a claim to the glory of her femininity against man. Not only does God thus reestablish the dignity of the feminine sex in general, but every woman will find special support in the celestial absence. As a human person, she carries little weight, but as soon as she acts in the name of divine inspiration, her desires become sacred. Madame Guyon says that, concerning a nun's illness, she learned what it meant to command by the word and obey by the same word. Thus the devotee camouflages her authority in humble obedience. Raising her children, governing a convent, or organizing a charity, she is but a docile tool in supernatural hands. One cannot disobey her without offending God himself. To be sure, men do not disdain this support either, but it loses its force when they encounter other men who make equal claim to it. The conflict finishes by being solved on a human level. Woman invokes divine will to justify her authority absolutely in the eyes of those who are naturally subordinated to her, and to justify it in her own eyes. If this cooperation is useful for her, it is because she is above all concerned with her relations with herself, even when those relations interest others. It is only in these totally interior debates that the supreme silence can have the force of law. In truth, woman uses the pretext of religion to satisfy her desires. Frigid, masochistic, or sadistic, she sanctifies herself by renouncing the flesh, playing the victim, stifling every living impulse around her, mutilating and annihilating herself, she rises in the ranks of the chosen. When she martyrs husband and children by depriving them of all terrestrial happiness, she is preparing them for a choice place in paradise. To punish herself for having sinned, Margaret of Cortona's pious biographers recount, she maltreated the child of her sin. She fed him only after feeding all the beggars she passed. We have seen that hatred of the unwanted child is common. It is a godsend to be able to express it in a virtuous rage. On her side, a woman whose morals are loose conveniently makes an arrangement with God. The certainty of being purified from sin by absolution tomorrow often helps the pious woman conquer her scruples now. Whether she has chosen asceticism or sensuality, pride or humility, the concern she has for her salvation encourages her to give in to this pleasure that she prefers over all others, taking care of self. She listens to her heartbeat. She watches every quiver of her flesh, justified by the presence of grace within herself, like the pregnant woman with her fruit. Not only does she examine herself with tender vigilance, but she reports to her confessor. In days gone by, she could savor the headiness of public confessions. We are told that Margaret of Cortona, to punish herself for an act of vanity, climbed onto her terrace and began to cry out like a woman in labor. "Wake up, people of Cortona! Wake up and bring candles and lanterns and come out to hear the sinner!" She enumerated all her sins, proclaiming her misery to the stars. By this noisy humility, she satisfied this need for exhibitionism, found in so many examples of narcissistic women. For the woman, religion authorizes self-indulgence. It gives her the guide, father, lover, titular divinity she nostalgically needs. It feeds her reveries. It fills her empty hours. But especially, it confirms the world order. It justifies resignation by bringing hope for a better future in an asexual heaven. This is why today women are still a powerful asset in the hands of the church. It is why the church is so hostile to any measure that might facilitate their emancipation. Women must have religion. There must be women, real women, to perpetuate religion. It is clear that woman's whole character, her convictions, values, wisdom, morality, tastes, and behavior, is explained by her situation. The fact that she is denied transcendence usually prohibits her from having access to the loftiest human attitudes, heroism, revolt, detachment, invention, and creation. But they are not so common, even in men. There are many men who are, like woman, confined within the domain of the intermediary, of inessential means. The worker escapes from it through political action, expressing a revolutionary will. But men from what we precisely call the middle class settle in this sphere deliberately, destined, like the woman, to the repetition of daily tasks, alienated in ready-made values, respecting public opinion, and only seeking vague comforts on earth. The employee, the shopkeeper, and the bureaucrat hold no superiority over their women companions. Cooking, washing, running her home, raising her children, the woman shows more initiative and independence than the man enslaved to orders. He must obey his superiors every day, wear a removable collar, and affirm his social rank. She can lie about in a housecoat in her apartment, sing, laugh with her women neighbors. She acts as she pleases, takes small risks, and efficiently tries to attain a few results. She lives much less according to convention and appearances than does her husband. The bureaucratic world described by Kafka, among others, this universe of ceremonies, absurd gestures, meaningless behavior, is essentially masculine. She has greater purchase on reality. When he lines up his figures or converts sardine boxes into money, he grasps nothing but abstracts. The child content in his cradle, clean laundry, the roast, are more tangible things. Yet, just because she feels their contingents, and consequently her own contingents, in the concrete pursuit of these objectives, it often happens that she does not alienate herself in them. She remains available. Man's undertakings are both projects and escapes. He lets himself be overwhelmed by his career, his personage. He is readily self-important, serious. Contesting masculine logic and morality, woman does not fall into these traps. That is what Stendhal appreciated so strongly in her. She does not resort to pride to elude the ambiguity of her condition. She does not hide behind the mask of human dignity. She reveals her undisciplined thoughts, her emotions, her spontaneous reactions with more sincerity. This is why her conversation is far less boring than her husband's whenever she speaks in her own name and not as her seigneur's loyal half. He recites so-called general ideas, meaning words and formulas found in the columns of his newspaper or in specialist works. She brings experience, limited but concrete. The famous feminine sensitivity is part myth, part theater, but the fact remains that woman is more attentive than man to herself and the world. Sexually, she lives in a crude masculine climate. She compensates by appreciating pretty things, which can lead to sentimentality, but also to refinement. Because her sphere is limited, the objects she touches are precious to her. By not binding them in concepts or projects, she displays their splendor. Her desire for escape is expressed in her taste for festiveness. She enjoys the gratuitousness of a bouquet of flowers, a cake, a well-laid table. She is pleased to transform the emptiness of her idle hours into a generous offering. Loving laughter, songs, adornment, and knick-knacks, she is also ready to welcome everything that palpitates around her. The spectacle of the street, of the sky, an invitation or an excursion offers her new horizons. The man often refuses to participate in these pleasures. When he comes home, joyous voices become silent, and the women in the family assume the bored and proper air expected of them. From the depths of solitude, of separation, the woman finds the sense of the singularity of her life. She has a more intimate experience than the man of the past, death, of time passing. She is concerned with the adventures of her heart, her flesh, her mind, because she knows that on earth she has but one lot, and also because she is passive. She bears the reality that submerges her in a more passionate manner, with more pathos than the individual absorbed by an ambition or job. She has the leisure and the tendency to abandon herself to her emotions, study her feelings, and draw conclusions from them. When her imagination is not lost in vain dreams, she becomes full of sympathy. She tries to understand the other in his uniqueness and recreate him in herself. Regarding her husband, her lover, she is capable of true identification. She makes his projects and his cares her own in a way he could not imitate. She watches anxiously over the whole world. It seems to be an enigma to her. Each being, every object, can be a reply. She questions avidly. When she grows older, her disenchanted expectation is converted into irony and often piquant cynicism. She refuses masculine mystifications. She sees the contingent, absurd, gratuitous reverse side of the imposing structure built by males. Her dependence prohibits detachment for her, but she draws real generosity from her imposed devotion. She forgets herself in favor of her husband, her lover, her child. She ceases to think of herself. She is pure offering, gift. Being poorly adapted to men's society, she is often forced to invent her own conduct. She is less able to settle for ready-made patterns and clichés. If she is of goodwill, her apprehensions are closer to authenticity than is her husband's self-confidence. But she will only have these advantages over her husband if she rejects the mystifications he offers her. In the upper classes, women are willing accomplices to their masters because they stand to profit from the benefits they are guaranteed. We have seen that women of the high bourgeoisie and aristocracy have always defended their class interests more stubbornly than their husbands. They do not hesitate to radically sacrifice their autonomy as human beings. They stifle all thinking, all critical judgment, all spontaneity. They parrot conventional wisdom. They identify with the ideal imposed on them by the male code. In their hearts and even on their faces, all sincerity is dead. The housewife regains independence in her work, in caring for the children. She draws a limited but concrete experience from it. A woman who is waited on no longer has any grasp on the world. She lives in dreams and abstraction, in a void. She is unaware of the reach of the ideas she professes. The words she rattles off have lost all meaning in her mouth. The banker, the businessman, and even at times the general take risks, accepting exhaustion and problems. They purchase their privileges in an unfair market, but at least they pay for them themselves. For all they receive, their wives give nothing, do nothing in return, and they even more righteously believe in their imprescriptible rights with a blind faith. Their vain arrogance, their radical incapability, their stubborn ignorance turn them into the most useless beings, the most idiotic that the human species has ever produced. It is thus as absurd to speak of the woman in general as of the eternal man. And we can see why all comparisons where we try to decide if the woman is superior, inferior, or equal to the man are pointless. Their situations are profoundly different. If these same situations are compared, it is obvious that the man's is infinitely preferable. That is to say, he has far more concrete opportunities to project his freedom in the world. The inevitable result is that masculine realizations outweigh by far those of women. For women, it is practically forbidden to do anything. But to compare the use that, within their limits, men and women make of their freedom is a priori meaningless, precisely because they use it freely. In various forms, the traps of bad faith and the mystifications of seriousness are lying in wait for both of them. Freedom is entire in each. However, because of the fact that in woman this freedom remains abstract and empty, it cannot authentically assume itself except in revolt. This is the only way open to those who have no chance to build anything. They must refuse the limits of their situation and seek to open paths to the future. Resignation is only a surrender and an evasion. For woman, there is no other way out than to work for her liberation. This liberation can only be collective, and it demands above all that the economic evolution of the feminine condition be accomplished. There have been, and there still are, many women who do seek to attain individual salvation on their own. They try to justify their existence within their own immanence, that is, to achieve transcendence through immanence. It is this ultimate effort, sometimes ridiculous, often pathetic, of the imprisoned woman to convert her prison into a heaven of glory, her servitude into sovereign freedom, that we find in the narcissist, the woman in love, and the mystic. Part 3. Justifications. Chapter 11. The Narcissist. It has sometimes been asserted that narcissism is the fundamental attitude of all women. Note, refer to Helena Deutsch, Psychology of Women. But overextending this notion destroys it, as La Rochefoucauld destroyed the notion of egotism. In fact, narcissism is a well-defined process of alienation. The self is posited as an absolute end, and the subject escapes itself in it. There are many other authentic or inauthentic attitudes found in woman. We have already studied some of them. What is true is that circumstances invite woman more than man to turn towards self and to dedicate her love to herself. All love demands the duality of a subject and an object. Woman is led to narcissism by two convergent paths. As subject, she is frustrated. As a little girl, she was deprived of this alter ego that the penis is for the boy. Later, her aggressive sexuality remained unsatisfied. Of far greater importance is that she is forbidden virile activities. She is busy, but she does not do anything. In her functions as wife, mother, and housewife, she is not recognized in her singularity. Man's truth is in the houses he builds, the forests he clears, the patients he cures. Not being able to accomplish herself in projects and aims, woman attempts to grasp herself in the imminence of her person. Parroting Sieyès's words, Marie Bashkirtseff wrote, "Who am I? Nothing. What would I like to be? All." It is because they are nothing that many women fiercely limit their interests to their self alone, that their self becomes hypertrophied so as to be confounded with all. "I am my own heroine," continues Marie Bashkirtseff. A man who acts necessarily confronts himself. Inefficient and separated, woman can neither situate nor assess herself. She gives herself sovereign importance because no important object is accessible to her. If she can put herself forward in her own desires, it is because since childhood she has seen herself as an object. Her education has encouraged her to alienate herself wholly in her body. Puberty having revealed this body as passive and desirable, it is a thing she can touch, that satin or velvet arouses, and that she can contemplate with a lover's gaze. In solitary pleasure, it may happen that the woman splits into a male subject and a female object. Dalbier studied the case of Irène, who said to herself, "I'm going to love myself," or more passionately, "I'm going to possess myself," or in a paroxysm, "I'm going to fecundate myself." Note, Dalbier, La méthode psychanalytique et la doctrine freudienne, Psychoanalytical Method and the Doctrine of Freud. In her childhood, Irène liked to urinate like boys. She often sees herself in her dreams in Undine form, which confirms Havelock Ellis's ideas on the relation between narcissism and what he calls undinism, that is, a certain urinary eroticism. Marie Bashkirtseff is also both subject and object when she writes, "It's really a pity that no one sees my arms and torso, all this freshness and youth." In truth, it is not possible to be for self positively other and grasp oneself as object in the light of consciousness. Doubling is only dreamed. For the child, it is the doll that materializes this dream. She recognizes herself in it more concretely than in her own body because there is separation between the two. Madame de Noailles expresses this need to be two so as to establish a tender dialogue between self and self in, among other works, Le Livre de ma vie, The Book of My Life. I loved dolls. I endowed their immobility with the life of my own existence. I could not have slept under the warmth of a cover if they were not also wrapped in wool and feathers. I dreamed of truly savoring pure solitude as two. This need to persist intact, to be twice myself, I felt it avidly as a little child. Oh, how I wanted in the tragic instance where my dreamy sweetness was the plaything of hurtful tears, to have another little Anna next to me, who would throw her arms around my neck, who would console me, understand me. During my life, I met her in my heart and I held her tight. She helped me not in the form of hoped-for consolation, but in the form of courage. The adolescent girl leaves her dolls dormant, but throughout her life, woman will be vigorously encouraged to leave and come back to herself by the magic of the mirror. Otto Rank brought to light the mirror-double relation in Myths and Dreams. It is above all in woman that the reflection allows itself to be assimilated to the self. Male beauty is a sign of transcendence. That of woman has the passivity of immanence. The latter alone is made to arrest man's gaze and can thus be caught in the immobile trap of the mirror silvering. Man who feels and wants himself to be activity and subjectivity does not recognize himself in his immobile image. It does not appeal to him, since the man's body does not appear to him as an object of desire, while the woman, knowing she is and making herself object, really believes she is seeing herself in the mirror. Passive and given, the reflection is a thing like herself, and as she covets feminine flesh, her flesh, she enlivens the inert qualities she sees with her admiration and desire. Madame de Noailles, who knew about this, confides to us, "I was less vain about the gifts of the mind, so vigorous in me that I did not doubt them, than about the image reflected by a frequently consulted mirror. Only physical pleasure satisfies the soul fully." The words physical pleasure are vague and inadequate here. What satisfies the soul is that, while the mind will have to prove its worth, the contemplated face is here, today, given and indubitable. The whole future is concentrated in this rectangle of light, and its frame makes a universe. Outside these narrow limits, things are no more than disorganized chaos. The world is reduced to this piece of glass where one image shines, the one and only. Every woman drowned in her reflection reigns over space and time, alone, sovereign. She has total rights over men, fortune, glory, and sensual pleasure. Marie Bashkirtseff was so intoxicated by her beauty that she wanted to fix it in indestructible marble. It is herself she would have thus destined to immortality. Coming home, I get undressed. I am naked and am struck by the beauty of my body, as if I had never seen it. A statue has to be made of me. But how? Without getting married, it is almost impossible. And I have to. I would only get ugly, spoiled. I have to take a husband, if only to have my statue made. Cécile Sorel, preparing for an amorous rendezvous, depicts herself like this. I am in front of my mirror. I would like to be more beautiful. I fight with my lion's mane. Sparks fly from my comb. My head is a sun in the middle of my tresses, set like golden rays. I also recall a young woman I saw one morning in the restroom of a cafe. She was holding a rose, and she looked a little drunk. She brought her lips to the mirror as if to drink her image, and she was murmuring while smiling, "Adorable, I find myself adorable." Both priestess and idol, the narcissist crowned with glory, hovers in the heart of eternity, and on the other side of the clouds, kneeling creatures worship her. She is God contemplating himself. "I love myself. I am my God," said Madame Majorowski. To become God is to realize the impossible synthesis of the in itself and for itself. The moments an individual thinks he has succeeded are special times of joy, exaltation, and plenitude. One day in an attic, Roussel, at 19, felt the aura of glory around his head. He never got over it. The girl who saw beauty, desire, love, and happiness deep in her mirror, endowed with her own features, animated, so she thinks, by her own consciousness, will try her whole life to use the promises of this blinding revelation. "It is you I love," confides Marie Bashkirtseff to her reflection one day. Another day she writes, "I love myself so much. I make myself so happy that I was as if crazy at dinner." Even if the woman is not of irreproachable beauty, she will see her soul's unique riches appear on her face, and that will be enough to make her drunk. In the novel where she portrayed herself as Valérie, Madame Krudner describes herself like this. "She has something special that I have never yet seen in any woman. One can be as graceful, much more beautiful, and be far from her. She is perhaps not admired, but she has something ideal and charming that makes one pay attention, seeing her so delicate, so svelte, that she is a thought." It should not be surprising that those less advantaged might sometimes experience the ecstasy of the mirror. They are moved by the mere fact of being a thing of flesh, which is there. Like man, all they need is the pure generosity of young feminine flesh. And since they grasp themselves as a singular subject, with a little bad faith, they will also endow their generic qualities with an individual charm. They will discover some gracious, rare, or amusing feature in their face or body. They will think they are beautiful just because they feel they are women. Moreover, the mirror is not the only instrument of doubling, although it is the favored one. Each person can try to create a twin brother in his inner dialogue. Alone most of the day, fed up with household tasks, woman has the leisure to shape her own figure and dreams. As a young girl, she dreamed of the future. Trapped in an uncertain present, she tells her story to herself. She retouches it so as to introduce an aesthetic order, transforming her contingent life into a destiny well before her death. We know, for example, how attached women are to their childhood memories. Women's literature makes it clear. In general, childhood takes a secondary place in men's autobiographies. Women, on the other hand, often go no further than recounting their early years. These are the favorite subjects of their novels and stories. A woman who confides in a woman friend or a lover almost always begins her stories with these words. When I was a little girl, they are nostalgic for this period when they felt their father's beneficent and imposing hand on their head while tasting the joys of independence. Protected and justified by adults, they were autonomous individuals with a free future opening before them. Now, however, they are poorly protected by marriage and love and have become servants or objects, imprisoned in the present. They reigned over the world, conquering it day after day, and now they are separated from the universe, doomed to imminence and repetition. They feel dispossessed, but what they suffer from the most is being swallowed up in generality. A wife, mother, housewife, or one woman among millions of others. As a child, by contrast, the woman lived her condition in an individual way. She was unaware of the analogies between her apprenticeship to the world and that of her friends. Through her parents, teachers, and friends, she was recognized in her individuality. She thought herself incomparable to any other woman, unique, promised to unique possibilities. She returns emotionally to this younger sister whose freedom, demands, and sovereignty she abdicated and whom she more or less betrayed. The woman she has become misses this human being she was. She tries to find this dead child in her deepest self. The words little girl move her, but what a funny little girl do even more. Words that revive her lost originality. She is not satisfied with marveling from afar at this precious childhood. She tries to revive it in her. She tries to convince herself that her tastes, ideas, and feelings have kept their exceptional freshness. Perplexed, quizzical, and playing with her necklace or twisting her ring, she murmurs, "That's funny. That's just how I am, you know? Water fascinates me. Oh, I adore the countryside." Each preference seems like an eccentricity, each opinion a challenge to the world. Dorothy Parker captured this widespread true-to-life characteristic. She liked to think of herself as one for whom flowers would thrive, who must always have blossoms about her if she would be truly happy. She told people in little bursts of confidence that she loved flowers. There was something almost apologetic in her way of uttering her tender avowal, as if she would beg her listeners not to consider her too bizarre in her taste. It seemed rather as though she expected the hearer to fall back, startled at her words, crying, "Not really? Well, what are we coming to?" She had other little confessions of affection, always with a little hesitation, as if understandably delicate about bearing her heart. She told her love for color, the country, a good time, a really interesting play, nice materials, well-made clothes and sunshine. But it was her fondness for flowers that she acknowledged oftenest. She seemed to feel that this, even more than her other predilections, set her apart from the general. Note, too bad. Translation. The woman eagerly tries to confirm these analyses in her behavior. She chooses a color. Green is really my color. She has a favorite flower, perfume, musician, superstitions, and fetishes that she treats with respect. She does not have to be beautiful to express her personality in her outfits and home. The character she portrays is more or less coherent and original, according to her intelligence, obstinacy, and depth of alienation. Some women just randomly put together a few sparse and mismatched traits. Others systematically create a figure whose role they consistently play. It has already been said that women have trouble differentiating this game from the truth. Around this heroine, life goes on like a sad or marvelous novel, always somewhat strange. Sometimes it is a novel already written. I do not know how many girls have told me they see themselves in Judy of Dust. Note, Colette Audry. Translation. I remember an old, very ugly lady who used to say, "Read the Lily of the Valley." It's my story. Note, Balzac, translation. As a child, I used to contemplate this wilted lily for hours. Others more vaguely murmur, "My life is a novel." A good or bad star hovers over them. Things like this only happen to me, they say. Rotten luck dogs them, or good luck smiles on them. In any case, they have a destiny. Cécile Sorel writes with a naivete that characterizes her memoir. This is how I made my debut in the world. My first friends were genius and beauty. And in The Book of My Life, a fabulous narcissistic monument, Madame de Noailles writes, "The governesses disappeared one day. Chance took their place. It mistreated the creature both powerful and weak, as much as it had satisfied it. It kept it from shipwrecks, where it was like a combative Ophelia, saving her flowers and whose voice ever rises. It asked the creature to hope that this final promise be kept. The Greeks use death." This other example of narcissistic literature must be cited. From the sturdy little girl I was, with delicate but rounded arms and legs and healthy cheeks, I acquired a more frail physique, more evanescent, that made me a pathetic adolescent, in spite of the source of life that can spring forth from my desert, my famine, and my brief and mysterious deaths, as strangely as Moses' rock. I will not boast of my courage, as I have the right to. It is part of my strength, my luck. I could describe it as one says, I have green eyes, black hair, a small and powerful hand. And these lines, too. Today I can recognize that, bolstered by my soul and its harmonious powers, I have lived to the sound of my voice. Without beauty, brilliance, or happiness, woman will choose the character of a victim. She will obstinately embody the mater dolorosa, the misunderstood wife. She will be the unhappiest woman in the world. This is the case of this melancholic woman Stekel describes. Each time around Christmas, Mrs. H.W. appears at my office, pale-faced, clad in somber black, and complains of her fate. She relates a sad story while tears stream down her face. A thwarted existence, an unfortunate marriage. The first time I was moved to tears and would have almost wept with her. 2 years have since flown. Note, Stekel says 10 years. Translation. But she is still at the threshold of her hopes, still bewailing her misspent life. Her face begins to show the early signs of the disintegration brought on by age. She thus has an additional reason for bemoaning her fate. What has become of me? I was once so beautiful and so much admired. Her complaints are cumulative. She stresses her despair. Her friends are well familiar with her sad plight. She makes herself a nuisance to everybody with her perpetual complaints. This, in turn, again, furnishes her the opportunity to feel herself lonely, abandoned, not understood. This woman found her satisfaction in the tragic role. The thought that she was the unhappiest woman on earth intoxicated her. All attempts to awaken her interest in the active current life ended in failure. Note, frigidity in woman. A trait shared by young Mrs. Weldon, stunning Anna de Noailles, Stekel's unfortunate patient, and the multitude of women marked by an exceptional destiny, is that they feel misunderstood. Their family and friends do not recognize, or inadequately recognize, their singularity. They transform this ignorance, this indifference of others, into the positive idea that they hold a secret inside them. The fact is that many have silently buried childhood and youthful memories that had a great importance for them. They know their official biography is not to be confused with their real history. But above all, because she has not realized herself in her life, the heroine cherished by the narcissist is merely an imaginary character. Her unity does not come from the concrete world. It is a hidden principle, a kind of strength, virtue, as obscure as phlogistonism. The woman believes in its presence, but if she wanted to show it to others, she would be as bothered as the psychasthenic, determined to confess to intangible crimes. In both cases, the secret is reduced to the empty conviction of possessing in one's deepest self a key to decipher and justify feelings and behavior. It is their ebullia and inertia that give this illusion to psychasthenics, and it is because of her inability to express herself in daily action that woman believes an inexpressible mystery inhabits her. The famous myth of the eternal feminine encourages her in this and is thus, in turn, confirmed. Enriched by these misunderstood treasures, whether she be under a lucky or an unlucky star, woman, in her own eyes, adopts the tragic hero's need to be governed by destiny. Her whole life is transfigured into a sacred drama. In her solemnly chosen dress emerges both a priestess clothed in holy garb and an idol attired by faithful hands, offered for the adoration of devotees. Her home becomes her temple of worship. Marie Bashkirtseff gives as much care to the decoration she places around her as to her dresses. Near the desk, an old-style armchair, so that upon entering, I need make only a small movement in the chair to find myself facing the people. Near the pedantic-looking desk with books in the background, in between paintings and plants, legs and feet visible instead of being cut in two as before by this black wood. Hanging above the divan are two mandolins and the guitar. Put a blonde and white girl with fine small blue-veined hands in the middle of this. When she parades in salons, when she abandons herself on the arm of a lover, the woman accomplishes her mission. She is Venus, dispensing the treasures of her beauty to the world. It is not she herself. It is beauty that Cécile Sorel defended when she broke the glass covering Bibb's caricature of her. One can see in her memoir that she invited mortals to the cult of art at each moment of her life. Likewise, Isadora Duncan, as she depicts herself in My Life. After a performance in my tunic, with my hair crowned with roses, I was so lovely. Why should not this loveliness be enjoyed? A man who labors all day with his brain, why should he not be taken in those beautiful arms and find comfort for his pain and a few hours of beauty and forgetfulness? The narcissist's generosity is profitable to her. Better than in mirrors, it is in others' admiring eyes she sees her double haloed in glory. Without a complacent audience, she opens her heart to a confessor, doctor, or psychoanalyst. She will consult chiromancers, mediums. "It's not that I believe in it," said an aspiring starlet, "but I love it so much when I'm spoken about." She talks about herself to her women friends more avidly than in anything else. She seeks a witness in the lover. The woman in love quickly forgets herself, but many women are incapable of real love, precisely because they never forget themselves. They prefer the wider stage to the privacy of the bedroom, thus the importance of society life for them. They need gazes to contemplate them, ears to listen to them. They need the widest possible audience for their personage. Describing her room once more, Marie Bashkirtseff reveals, "Like this, I am on stage when someone enters and finds me writing." And further on, "I decided to buy myself a considerable mise-en-scene. I am going to build a more beautiful townhouse and grander workshops than Sarah's." And Madame de Noailles writes, "I loved and love the Agora, and so I have often reassured my friends, who apologized for the many guests they feared I would be importuned by with this sincere admission. I don't like to play to empty seats." Dressing up and conversation largely satisfy this feminine taste for display, but an ambitious narcissist wants to exhibit herself in a more recherché and varied way. In particular, making her life a play offered to public applause, she will take delight in really staging herself. In Corinne, Madame de Stael recounts at length how she charmed Italian crowds by reciting poems that she accompanied on a harp. At Coppée, one of her favorite pastimes was to declaim tragic roles. Playing Phèdre, she would readily make ardent declarations to young lovers whom she dressed up as Hippolytus. Madame Krudener specialized in the dance of the shawl that she describes in Valérie. Valerie required a dark blue muslin shawl. She took her hair away from her forehead. She put the shawl on her head. It went down along her temples and shoulders. Her forehead appeared in an antique manner. Her hair disappeared. Her eyelids lowered. Her usual smile faded little by little. Her head bent. Her shawl fell softly on her crossed arms, on her bust. And this blue piece of clothing and this pure and gentle figure seemed to have been drawn by Correggio to express tranquil resignation. And when her eyes looked up and her lips dared a smile, one could say that one was seeing, as Shakespeare described it, patience smiling at pain in front of a monument. One has to see Valerie. She is simultaneously timid, noble, and profoundly sensitive, and she troubles, leads, moves, draws tears, and makes the heart beat as it beats when dominated by a great ascendant. It is she who possesses this charming grace that cannot be taught, but that nature secretly reveals to some superior beings. If circumstances allow it, nothing will give the narcissist deeper satisfaction than devoting herself publicly to the theater. "The theater," says Georgette Leblanc, "provided me what I had sought in it, a reason for exaltation. Today it is for me the caricature of action, something indispensable for excessive temperaments." The expression she uses is striking. If she cannot take action, the woman invents substitutes for action. The theater represents a privileged substitute for some women. The actress can have very different aims. For some, acting is a means of earning one's living, a simple profession. For others, it is access to fame that will be exploited for amorous aims. For still others, the triumph of their narcissism. The greatest, Rachel, Eleonora Duse, are authentic artists who transcend themselves in the roles they create. The ham, by contrast, cares not for what she accomplishes, but for the glory that will cascade over her. She seeks, above all, to put herself in the limelight. The stubborn narcissist will be as limited in art as in love because she does not know how to give herself. This failing will be seriously felt in all her activities. She will be tempted by all roads leading